Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller, and very pleased to be talking about autism spectrum disorders. We're going to talk about it from two different angles, at least from the academic side with Wendy Mihalicek, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Psychology and Special Education at UW-Madison. She is joining us from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Judith.
Hi, great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And here in the studio, we have Jacqueline Houtman, who is a science writer and the author of the award-winning novel for young people, The Reinvention of Edison Thomas. Jacqueline, thanks for coming in.
No, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out, Wendy, with you talking a little bit about autism spectrum disorders. What does that encompass? Why is the word spectrum in there?
Sure. So autism spectrum disorders are characterized by a triad of symptoms, generally communication and social delays, difficulties with social and emotional reciprocity or developing relationships with other people, and restricted and repetitive behaviors and interests, which can include stereotypy or what is generally called stimming, hand flapping, body rocking, or just perseverative interest or rigidity in routines, having to do routines in a certain way. Hmm. It's termed a spectrum disorder because there's such a wide range of abilities. And on the spectrum are included children and individuals who have Asperger's syndrome. And children with Asperger's syndrome, adults with Asperger's syndrome, do not have the communication delays that children with more severe diagnoses of autism, classic autism or PDD and OS, generally have.
Now, Wendy, when I was in grade school in the 1970s and high school in the 1980s, it doesn't seem like this was talked about, or at least they weren't phrases or things that were used in common conversations, like I think they are more so today. Was it identified then and not discussed, or was it really not recognized?
Well, Asperger's was first discussed in the 40s by a pediatrician, Hans Asperger's, but in general, there is an increase of autism. Right now, autism spectrum disorders occur in 1 in 110 children under the age of 8, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And Asperger's is relatively less prevalent, with 0.26 in 1,000 individuals. And so the prevalence rate has been increasing, and certainly more children are mainstreamed into public schools, which may have something to do with the amount of interest and notice of this disorder and perhaps discussion in the popular media.
You know, looking back, especially in grade school, I'm thinking of some kids that I went to grade school with that most likely, I think, were dealing with issues like Eddie, who is the protagonist of Jacqueline's book, The Reinvention of Edison Thomas. But certainly there didn't seem to be the support or the recognition, certainly not by the other kids. And it didn't seem to me like by the teachers or the administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think a lot of us see a lot of ourselves in a character like Eddie. And that's, you know, it's not unusual for young children, particularly in middle school, to have social difficulties, difficulty making friends, dealing with bullying. I think that a lot of the issues that individuals with Asperger's syndrome in particular face are just, they're part of growing up, and perhaps they have more significant deficits in those areas. But I think that may have something to do with what you're saying, in that, you know, there are children within the classroom that may not have a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome or autism, but may have some quirky interest, may be rigid in some way, or may be highly intelligent, like Eddie, our character in Jacqueline's story, but may not have a diagnosis or receive services.
Is there a connection at all with obsessive compulsive disorder? Because that, you know, needing to do things in a certain way and repetitive motion, it almost seems like there might be some connection.
Yeah, there's certainly some of the rigidity and the restricted interest in Asperger's syndrome and in autism actually looks a lot like obsessive compulsive disorder, although they are different diagnoses. And someone could actually have both diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's turn to Jacqueline. You're a scientist yourself, and you're a big proponent of what you call science-y fiction, not science fiction necessarily, but science-y fiction, where science really plays a key part in the plot, not just that suddenly somebody flies off to another planet, but real science. The character of Edison Thomas, or Eddie, who's the protagonist in The Reinvention of Edison Thomas, is not only fascinated by science, but in some ways it's really how he relates to the world. And it sounds like that's pretty typical for kids with Asperger's syndrome.
I would say it occurs in kids with Asperger's syndrome, but I don't think it's a typical. I mean, autism and Asperger's is a part of who the character is, who Eddie is. But, I mean, he also loves science, whether that's because of his autism or in addition to his autism, who knows? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people in this world who are really into science and don't have any signs of autism. But, yeah, he really, I mean, I grew up as a scientist. I spent 27 years going to school to be a scientist. And so I think like a scientist. And I come from a family of scientists and engineers, and I married into a family of scientists and engineers. So that's sort of how my brain works. I mean, I think like a scientist. So I would write a character who thinks like a scientist, too.
In the book, you don't ever identify what Eddie's diagnosis might be, but because he's getting extra help, especially with social interactions and stress management, it's clear that he's in the system and he's been identified as needing this extra support. Why did you choose not to state explicitly what Eddie might be dealing with?
Well, that was a real conscious choice. I wanted the reader to really get to identify with the character as a person first, and not to have a label to sort of pigeonhole him, stereotype him, label him as other or different. You know, you could say, I'm reading about this character with Asperger's syndrome who is nothing at all like me because I don't have Asperger's syndrome. And so without that label, they can understand his challenges and understand his gifts and get to know him and identify with him as a person. There is a downside to not using the A word anywhere in the book, and that is that it's really hard for people who are looking specifically for a book with an autistic protagonist to find it, and I'm finding that to be one of the toughest things, which is why I do things like come on the radio.
And do a lot of school visits, right? You go to, in fact, you said you were going to a school this afternoon. How do the kids relate to that?
Well, they love it. I mean, whenever an author comes into a school, they're like, oh, wow, a real famous author. Do you know Stephen King?
But, and do you?
No, I don't. I know Cynthia Lord, though. It's really fun because the kids are so enthusiastic, and they really they tell you everything you'd want to know about your book. They draw pictures. They ask the greatest questions. Stuff. I mean, they find stuff in the book that I never even knew I put in.
Teachers? I mean, I'm guessing that a lot of your intended audience is parents, teachers, you know, counselors, just adults in the general population who might really benefit from understanding a little more about how some kids might struggle and the gifts that they have.
Yeah, I hope so. I've gotten some feedback on that, about that. Yeah, I mean, I wrote it so that people who read the book would sort of get to see the world the way Eddie sees it. And I think that's real important when you're dealing with someone who is a little different, is to figure out what his differences are and how they affect what he does. Because what he does, you may have an entirely different motivation for doing an action, but if you understand his motivation, it makes it a lot easier to understand his behavior.
And I want to make sure that our listeners know how to join in on the conversation. We're talking today with Wendy Mihalicek, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Psychology and Special Education at UW-Madison. Also, Jacqueline Houtman, who is a science writer and the author of the award-winning middle grade novel, The Reinvention of Edison Thomas. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Cynthia Schuster is our on-air producer today. She will get your questions to us one way or another. And you can also post on our Facebook page, which is The Larry Mueller Show. Do you or someone in your life deal with autism? Teachers, have you had children with autism in your classes? And do Eddie's experiences ring true for you? We'd love to hear from you. Again, 1-800-642-1234. Jacqueline, it would be great if you could read a short passage from Eddie. This passage is after the school science fair, where Eddie's sure that he's going to take top prize because, as we said, he's very adept and very passionate about science, and he doesn't for a variety of reasons. So if you can read us that passage, that would be great.
Great. And another thing you should probably know is that at the science fair, he had somebody put a note on his back that said, I am a geek. Fact number 305 from the Random Access Memory of Edison Thomas. In the 14th century, shoemakers began to make shoes that fit either the right or left foot. Before that, right and left shoes were identical. Eddie's session with Tiffany took longer than it should have. Tiffany had some new computer software that showed video clips of famous actors and actresses in movies. Eddie had to decide what emotions they were showing. He did fine with the scenes from movies in his own collection of science fiction and fantasy DVDs, but had to guess at the unfamiliar ones, and the harder he tried, the worse he did. He didn't want to leave until he had reached level 2, but Tiffany finally convinced him that he needed to quit. As always, Eddie tensed up when he entered the lunchroom, trying to defend his brain from the onslaught of noise and smells and the visual clutter of hundreds of kids. He preferred to sit in the corner of the room, which was quieter and had walls instead of people on two sides. Unfortunately, he was so late today that his usual corner was not available. It looked like a spot was open at Mitch's table, even though three girls he didn't recognize had joined the usual lunchtime trio of Mitch, Will, and Mark. Mitch sure had a lot of friends. "Hey, Mitch," said Eddie, "can I sit with you?"
"Sorry, Professor, that seat is saved," replied Mitch.
"Yeah, for humans," muttered Mark. The girls giggled.
"Maybe some other time," said Mitch. "I see some seats over on the other side of the room, way over there."
"Thank you," said Eddie. He turned, stumbled slightly, and walked away. He heard Will mumble something that sounded to Eddie like Homo sapiens, and the girls giggled again. Eddie made his way to the other side of the room, but he didn't see any open spots. He did see Keisha Davis, first place finisher at the science fair. She was laughing with some friends, obviously pleased with herself. No room for Eddie there. He stood looking for a place to sit, trying not to panic, when a voice came from behind him. "There's room at my table, Eddie." He turned to see a small kid with messy hair the color of sandstone and large glasses to match. He recognized him from the science fair. Was this the kid that put the geek note on Eddie's back? Eddie was too hungry to care at the moment, so he sat down and started to eat his lunch.
"My name is Justin Peterson," said the boy.
"Eddie Thomas," said Eddie.
"I know. Congratulations on finishing third in the science fair," said Justin.
Eddie grunted as he chewed on his sandwich. Peanut butter, chunky, and honey, also known as bee vomit, on whole wheat, stone ground. He didn't want to be reminded of his failure.
"What would happen if the ring was made of a metal besides copper?" asked Justin.
"Non-ferrous metals like aluminum would be repelled by the induced field, just like copper," explained Eddie. "But ferrous metals like iron or steel or nickel would be attracted."
"Like they would be attracted to a magnet."
"Exactly. In that case, the coil would be acting as an electromagnet." Eddie bit into his apple. Malus Domestica, Variety, Macintosh.
Thanks for that. That was a passage from The Reinvention of Edison Thomas, read by Jacqueline Hauptmann, the author. And this book, you know, it's for young people. But I have to say, as an adult, I got really sucked in and really enjoyed it on several levels. And, you know, the perspective of writing from Eddie, from how Eddie sees the world is really important. Wendy, I'd like you to come back in here. Tiffany is a character. She's a special education support person for Eddie. Mm-hmm. What kind of things is Tiffany most likely doing with Eddie?
Well, she, you know, there's a couple of things going on there. One of the things that she mentions is that, or that he mentions rather, Eddie, is that he's watching videos, video clips of famous movie characters and trying to identify the emotions on their faces. So individuals with Asperger's syndrome, Eddie most likely has some difficulty interpreting other people's facial expressions, which we see with his interactions, particularly with Mitch. He doesn't know that he's bullying him. It takes him a while to realize that he's actually got perhaps a mean look on his face or a look of disdain. And so that may be one thing that they're doing with the software program that Tiffany's using, is that they're actually showing him different examples of, you know, this is what angry looks like and this is what frustration looks like. Now it's your turn. You tell me what these are like. So oftentimes that's a key deficit for individuals on the spectrum, is that they have a difficult time understanding what other people's facial expressions mean. Oftentimes because they're not necessarily focused on other people's faces, may lack some eye contact and may have some difficulty with that. Tiffany may also be doing what we call priming, which is a really good strategy and an evidence-based strategy for priming or readying the person for the next difficult situation. So but having that before lunch could have made it easier for him to figure out social situations during lunchtime, which seemed to be a difficult time for him.
It sounds like the character of Tiffany also focuses on giving him some skills to deal with stressful situations. Jacqueline, Tiffany has him imagining being on, I think, a beach.
Yeah.
And you know, try in poor Eddie, I'm not using that in any derogatory way, but poor Eddie is, you know, in the midst of this chaos of a science fair, which I have to say, walking into a gym full of kids, adults and everything and all that can be overwhelming for anyone. And here he is, you know, thinking, I have my toes in the sand and right. The breeze, you know, right. and he's really trying to follow those directions. But it's also kind of an overwhelming experience for anybody.
Right. And, you know, Tiffany has this idea that if he imagines this place, then he'll feel calm. And, you know, and that works for her. But guess what? For Eddie, reciting the periodic table of elements is a lot more calming for him. So he's sort of come up with his own strategy that works better for him.
We are talking with Wendy Mihalicek, an assistant professor in the Department of Rehabilitation, Psychology, and Special Education at UW-Madison, and Jacqueline Hauptman, who's a science writer and the author of the award-winning novel for young people, The Reinvention of Edison Thomas. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking today about autism spectrum disorders, and we have a couple callers on the phone. So let's go first to Barbara in Green Bay. Hi, Barbara.
Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Thank you. I called because I have a grandson that I've seen symptoms since he was an infant. He's now 11 years old and struggling in school and struggling with many of the things you talk about. And my daughter has never addressed it head-on as Asperger's or autism. She's been through the school system. They've suggested psychological evaluations and ADD testing, and it hasn't really come to that. But she's totally frustrated in terms of how to get him, like for instance, even tutoring in school. And I wondered what direction she might be able to go. I was just talking to her this morning. Is it possible for her to contact Wendy?
Barbara, you're in Green Bay. Where are your daughter and grandson?
I'm in Green Bay. She's up in the Cribbets area.
Okay. Wendy, do you have some ideas of some resources?
You know, that's a difficult situation because in the public schools, you need a diagnosis in order to receive specialized services and supports. So if indeed your grandson's experiencing some difficulties, it might be worth your daughter considering having him evaluated for a diagnosis so that he could receive supports and services free of charge from the school. As far as tutoring, you know, there's a number of places that are generally private or nonprofit places that would provide tutoring for children with or without disabilities. And so that may also be an option within your community. And your school social worker or the district social worker might be able to provide you some more information in that regard, or your grandson's teacher.
Barbara, I'm going to have our on-air producer, Cynthia, get your contact information, and then we can pass that along
to
Wendy.
Thank you.
So just hold
on. Sounds good.
One of the questions, I think, Wendy, is, you know, how much do those services that are available vary? You know, it sounds like Barbara's grandson is in a more rural area. Are there additional challenges when somebody is maybe not in one of the major metro areas?
There can absolutely be additional challenges, and I often say that people in rural areas can be at a double disadvantage, not only because they might be a little more isolated. Parents may have a more difficult time finding other parents of children with the same sort of struggles to talk with about some of the issues that they're facing, but their school may also be less prepared to deal with an unusual diagnosis. And although autism is fairly prevalent at this point within our schools, there are still rural areas where there may be 4 children with autism within a district. And so schools often will resort to having district specialists come in, which may vary the amount of services or the amount of expertise that's on hand. Certainly, you know, new technology is helping with that. A lot of clinicians are actually using video conferencing.
Like almost distance learning techniques.
Yeah, absolutely. To actually provide therapy to children with Asperger's syndrome because, you know, they can interact in that sort of way over the internet, or just to provide parent education or teacher education over the internet.
Great. Thanks for that call, Barbara. And let's go to Barb in Oshkosh. Hi, Barb.
Hello. This is a great show and perfect timing for me. I babysit with my grandchildren up in Appleton 3 days a week. My granddaughter is 7, and her best friend and nearest neighbor has Asperger's, and he's a little boy. And they play together very often. But the problem I'm having is sometimes he'll be walking home from school, and the little boy will invite her over, and then 3 minutes later he'll say, "Oh, I don't want Aspen to come over now. I changed my mind. She can't come over." And then my granddaughter starts to cry sometimes, or feels very sad when he does these things, because he like seems to switch very quickly from something like that. Or he's trying to kiss her and says he loves her, and then the next minute he says, "I'm not thinking of Aspen now. I don't want to talk to you now." And so I have never told her he has Asperger's, although I know he does. I don't know if I should tell her, mm-hmm. explain things to her. I don't know how to handle it.
Sure. Barb, let's ask Jacqueline first to address that.
Oh, my answer would be read my book. But actually only half kidding, because I think peer education is really important, that kids understand that, you know, the weird kid over there has his reasons for acting the way that you might consider weird. And if you can understand those reasons and sort of get to know where he's coming from, it's a lot easier to deal with him.
Well, and I think, too, me speaking as someone, you know, not at all well-versed in this, like Wendy and Jacqueline, I think, you know, it's not so important whether she knows that he has Asperger's, just developing that sense of empathy for people that might do things differently or act differently, you know, just being more accepting and supportive. And I think maybe one of the challenges that Barb is talking about is that her granddaughter is 7, and so her feelings get hurt, and, you know, kind of, so how do you, you know, strike that balance between the two?
You're asking me?
Sure. And then Wendy, too.
I think Wendy would have a better
answer. Wendy, what do you think?
That's a tough one. You know, I would agree that it's more important that the granddaughter would know what how she could respond. So if your feelings are hurt, how can you respond to another child? You can certainly tell them that your feelings are hurt. Another way that she might deal with it is to invite him over instead to her house, or to have a planned activity that they know that he really enjoys, so that he will follow through with it. Also, it could be, you know, having peers play together, it's really important for kids, just all kids on it, obviously, but especially for kids with who are on the spectrum, to have those opportunities. And oftentimes they do punish their friends sort of inadvertently. You know, they don't realize that they're hurting someone's feelings by changing their mind very quickly. And so he may actually benefit from the granddaughter telling him, "You're really hurt. This hurts my feelings," and just being very open about her feelings and saying, "You know, if you keep asking me and then you say no, never mind, I may stop coming over."
Well, and that too is a good
lesson as well.
Yeah, and it's a good lesson for her to be able to advocate for herself and express, you know, how she's feeling in a certain situation too, while being compassionate, you know, for what he's doing. Barb, have you had the experience of being there when some of those what turn out to be painful interactions happen?
Right. Yeah, I'm always with them at the time. Mm-hmm. And I have had them over a few times, and I did plan the day very well. I had activities planned, one right after the other, and then extra activities, because sometimes he won't last long in one, mm-hmm. and other ones he'll last forever in. So I always have a ton mm-hmm. of activities if I do have him over. At first, he would just run off all of a sudden out of clear blue. "I'm going home now." And then I would panic, like, "Oh, my gosh, he's going to run home."
Well, Barb, it sounds like you're putting a lot of thought into this. Wendy, is there something to be said for building in some quiet time, too?
It could be, sure. Like, he could be getting overwhelmed, and so there could be too many activities for him. So you might, you know, it sounds like you're doing a fantastic job of helping to structure their play and make it successful for both of them, and to have things that they both really enjoy doing. It can be really useful for social interactions to have things that they could do together, like building a snack together or working on a drawing together. But there might be some benefit to also alternating those kind of cooperative activities that he may see as demanding, but your daughter may enjoy even more with some activities that are parallel activities. So maybe quietly reading next to each other or listening to music or having a snack without any real demands that are social.
Great. Thanks for that call, Barb. And Kathleen and Madison, on to you. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. I'm 58 years old, and I'm one of the few baby boomers with Asperger's syndrome. I was diagnosed 2 years ago. I knew that there was something along those lines, but I didn't know how to go about getting a diagnosis until 2 years ago. And life has been hell. The upside of my Asperger's is I'm a gifted self-taught musician and crafter, but these skills are undermined by the problems. And, you know, for adults, there's nothing, no support services. Most of my energy, instead of going into music and crafting, it goes into just survival and dealing with chaos and chronic stress and trying to cobble together a support system from various sundry agencies, and a lot of times being, especially when I was younger, being turned down for badly needed services. And, you know, as I mentioned, I'm 58 years old. I've never smoked or drank or did drugs, but my chronic stress level impacts my life expectancy comparable to a heavy smoker. So my lifetime is running out, and it's very sad because I have a lot to offer, but just lack of opportunity. And so here I sit.
Thanks for sharing that, Kathleen. Wendy, would you like to comment on what it's like for adults who might get a diagnosis much later in life?
Yeah. You know, I can speak a little bit to that. My area of expertise is with younger individuals with autism, but certainly I've worked with some adults that have autism or who are on the spectrum. And it can be very difficult, as the caller mentioned, that it can be difficult to find services. There are certainly fewer services for adults who have Asperger's syndrome or who have autism. Partially, in part, because of our emphasis, and rightly so, I suppose, on early intervention to help prevent some of the social mm-hmm. difficulties later on. But that doesn't make these difficulties that adults who may be diagnosed later any less difficult. One thing that's been really interesting for me for talking with adults who have Asperger's syndrome is the sense of community that they've developed online. For instance, there's an autism community called Wrong Planet, and it's www.wrongplanet.net, I believe. And it's where people are actually chatting with one another who have generally Asperger's syndrome and who are talking about resources and sharing. And they're really a national or, worldwide community. And that's been something interesting for me to see, is that people are developing online support groups, partially because of the difficulty in social interactions that meeting face-to-face can pose or getting out of the house because of anxiety
right.
or depression.
And Kathleen was calling from Madison, and Jacqueline, it sounded like you might have some ideas,
well,
too.
The Autism Society of Greater Madison has some really great resources, and I would suggest that maybe she contact them.
Great. And we will definitely put up a link to wrongplanet.net on our Facebook page just a little later so people can connect to that easily. We have a couple calls that I'd like to take actually back to back because I think your responses might be similar to them. So let's go first to Bruce. Hi, Bruce. You're calling from Northwest Illinois?
Yes. And my wife, who's in her mid-40s, was just in the last few months diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. And it's something that, you know, it's a two-edged sword. On one side, knowing why she's always had these problems means she no longer has to blame herself for feeling guilty that she doesn't want to be with people who she's told, well, you should be with them. This is your friends, your relatives. You should enjoy this. On the other hand, people think autism, and they think Rain Man, and it's a label that she's afraid of having put on her, which would then make people think of her as less than what she is. She's extremely bright. She's extremely high-functioning. From the outside, she, and for that matter, a lot of women who have Asperger's, don't seem as socially clumsy, I say, as the males do. And that's the problem, is that I think that there's another friend of mine who's a female scientist just realized this is what she's been suffering with her whole life when she started going through all of the rocking and all these other things that she's always done and never put it all together and realized that these are her, you know, she's somewhere along that spectrum herself.
So it sounds like it's both a relief in some ways and a burden in other ways to have that diagnosis now.
It is. And, you know, it explains a lot. I mean, the relief is she doesn't have to blame herself anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why even adults who have it's worth getting the diagnosis to understand that you've been told since you were five, you know, get over it. Mm-hmm. And I have two female friends who've been told that mm-hmm. their whole life. And the point is, one of them, once when she finally was diagnosed, she goes, I've got my papers. I can prove now why I could not just get over it mm-hmm. and couldn't just at the drop of a hat change. And I think that there need to be services. The services out there for especially females, are adults, are very few far in between. Mm. And I think that's the next the next big wave is going to be all these women who have had this their whole life, and because they fit in socially better, were never allowed to be what they could be because their differences were, you know, it's hard to be in a job when you don't like to be in a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to play office politics, but that doesn't mean these people who think differently don't have a tremendous amount to add to a university or to a business if their coworkers, as one of your guests talked about, educating other people, if the coworkers understood how better to relate to them and how to ostracize them less, they would be able to contribute more and not feel as much of a pariah,
mm-hmm.
which is why they don't want to leave the house or go to work.
Right, and that really echoes what Kathleen, the previous caller, was saying, too, that I think she even used that same phrase, having so much to offer, but not being able to kind of negotiate those situations. Thank you very much for that call, Bruce. And I want to make sure we get to Jim in Kewaunee County, and then we'll have Wendy and Jacqueline comment after that. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, wow. I'm calling from the other side of the sun. I'm on the wrong planet.
Okay.
Well, anyway, the two people before me, my life has followed very similar lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I never, I'm a disabled vet on top of it. I graduated from college. I never could really hold a job very well. You know, I just couldn't read people. And, you know, I'm beginning to. I'm 64 years old. It's taken, and my diagnosis was about 3 years ago. And I'm just beginning to, the first year was really tough because I thought I would be just relieved, and I wasn't. I was just really angry.
Hmm. And angry because it took so long to get the diagnosis, or?
Well, you know, what my life could have been,
hmm.
You know, and you know, I'm not the end of my life, but you know, it's very. I just want to say that, you know, if there are young people out there that have this kind of problem, they really need to be helped because it'll just save so much grief.
Hmm.
It's very stressful when you can't control your life in a normal way. And, you know, pay your bills on time and control your money. And you know, I live in an old house trailer I got for nothing. I don't have running water. Right, you know, and I'm isolated. But I have a nice dog. And I have a lot of junk. And I'm really good at fixing things. And I got a degree in fine arts. And, you know, I still have hope that, you know, it's going to be better. And it is, you know, some mm-hmm. days. And, my life isn't that much different than yours. I don't want to, you know, just go on and on about my life because, you know, this show is just too important for, you know, to have other people have their input too.
Well, Jim, but your perspective adds more to this show than we could ever do ourselves. And thank you so much for sharing your experience. Jacqueline, what I saw you nodding your head a lot listening to Jim. What was really resonating with you?
Well, every book that I sign Great Minds Don't All Think Alike. And I think that really holds true. And we need to recognize that every person has their own gifts and every person has their own challenges. And what we need to do is help people use their gifts and overcome their challenges, no matter what they are.
And Wendy, what would you like to add?
You know, it really speaks, the last caller really was speaking about sort of the need for early intervention and the need for early identification so that children can receive support to help them be more successful early on. And certainly, you know, oftentimes people are not diagnosed until they're, you know, 5 years old with more severe autism and much later, as the previous three callers have identified, is that oftentimes there's a long lag between, starting to have some social difficulties or communication difficulties or both and the actual diagnosis.
And actually, going along with what you just said, Wendy, there was also a question from Carol from Green Bay. Are there any apparent symptoms of autism or Asperger's syndrome for children under the age of 1 year?
Absolutely. People are starting to diagnose autism reliably by the age of 1 year of age, and we're getting better and better at 18 months. And some researchers are actually identifying ways to reliably diagnose children below that age. The red flags of autism are really difficulty with social reciprocity. So for infants, no big smiles or warm, joyful expressions shared with other people by 6 months or after. Mm-hmm. No back and forth sharing of sounds, smiles, really a lack of communication showing up very early, before 9 months of, that should show up by 9 months of age. No babbling or talking no words by 16 months of age. Mm. And no two-word phrases by 2 years. And certainly any loss of speech or loss of social skills at any age. Mm.
Well, I want to make sure that we end on the positive note, because in The Reinvention of Edison Thomas, which is Jacqueline Houtman's book for young people, the protagonist, Eddie, I think my reading of the title, The Reinvention of Edison Thomas, is not so much that Eddie has to reinvent himself, but that he really blossoms and realizes that there are people that enjoy being around him for who he is. Mm. And that you know, he kind of has friends without having to make that effort, that he was trying to stay friends with people who really didn't understand and appreciate him. But there are other people who kind of find him. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that people will do nice things for him when there's really nothing in it for them that he can identify. And there's this sense of him really coming into himself and coming out of himself, I think, both. Jacqueline, what the process of writing the book, what did you take out of it?
Get out of writing the book. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot. I learned a lot, just a lot about the writing process, and learned a lot about science from all the science that's in the book. But I really sort of got into this imaginary kid's imaginary head, and it really helped me to see in all my interactions with people to try and think, well, you know, am I misinterpreting their motivations? Are they doing something that's a very good reason for them that I just might not understand? So it's really opened my mind to my interactions with other people.
Great. Well, this part of the program, unfortunately, is coming to a close. I want to thank Wendy Mihalicek, assistant professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Psychology and Special Education at UW-Madison, for joining us from Portland, Oregon, ironically, since she's a Madisonian. Thanks so much for being with us today, Wendy.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
And Jacqueline Hauptmann is the science writer and author of the award-winning book for young people, The Reinvention of Edison Thomas. Jacqueline's going to be doing a panel on social networking and signing copies of Eddie at the Southeast Wisconsin Festival of Books on the UW-Waukesha campus on June 17th. And her website about the book is www.edisonthomas.com. Jacqueline, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
We are going to switch gears just a bit right now. And we are going to come back in just a moment with Joan Hall of the Dictionary of American Regional English. And she is here to tell us why we say the things we do. Stay tuned.